Hello, listeners. This is the Pennsylvania Patriots podcast, and this is Steve. We're flying, well, I'm not flying solo today specifically. I have our next guest, Pat from Uncensored Tactical. Super cool dude, high speed, low drag motherfucker, in my opinion. Super chill. So how you doing today, Pat?
Good, man. I'm really happy to be on here. I appreciate the offer.
And I appreciate it too, you taking time out of your very busy schedule to be on here. And like I said, I very greatly appreciate it. And how about you throw out some plugs? Heard you just got a new book. I picked up a copy for myself, and I'm much enjoying it so far.
Thank you. The book is called Tactical Lockpicking. It is my own creation of my own curriculum on lockpicking, restraint escapes, and other bypass methods to get through locked obstacles in the field. I think it is a great skill set for your shooters, your breachers, your firefighters, EMS, the prepared citizen, your survivalist, all that stuff. It's just knowing how to get yourself from one place through an obstacle into another place is just a huge life skill set that even professionals don't often know that. So I wanted to bring that to the world, and I wanted to bring my take on it, my humor, and hopefully a lot of value to that. You can find it on my website or on Amazon. My website is uncensoredtactical.com, all one word. And you can find almost everything else from that. So I'm happy there.
All right. Thanks for the introduction here, Pat. So I guess this episode is just going to be really kind of just loosely organized, the typical shit show that it usually is. But now we have a guest that's actually very interesting, in my opinion.
Thanks.
And if I imagine if you're listening to this, you've already been listening to Pat. But I do like your take on how you deliver your course. And even with your mindset, you may not exactly agree with, I wouldn't say agree with your clientele that your courses are designed primarily focused on, like first responders, police, military, like that. Although you may not, I guess you could say, agree with, how do I put it, the machine that they work for, but you still offer your services to pretty much anyone as long as they're willing to use that information for, I guess, the pursuit of good.
Yeah, that's an unfortunate thing that a lot of libertarians have to tackle. Regardless of your politics, there really is only one group of people you can go to when there's a big ass emergency that you have to handle. So regardless of what you think about the machine or government or taxes, whatever, when you need help and someone's in fucking trouble, the best, still for now, often the best people to call is that dispatcher, that 911. And I teach my content to people that are willing to learn. And I teach to civilians. I teach the exact same curriculum to civilians as I do to military people. I don't have any super secret techniques that I only teach the government. I don't do any of that crap. Nothing about this is proprietary, meaning it's not like I have the codes to the football the president carries. Like, none of what I say.
It'd be a lot cooler if you did.
It would be. Yeah. Right. None of what I say is something you can't acquire on your own, or you can't acquire from somebody else, or you can't acquire open source. So, yeah, regardless of your politics, I teach people that are willing to learn.
And, you know, that's the mindset that we pretty much should all have, because isn't that really what the Liberty community is all about? You know, you do you. You know, you can think however you want to think, just don't come and, affect me with it. And that's how I've always thought. You know, if you're not hurting me, what do I care? Which I'm trying to stay away from, you know, I guess you could say calling 911 or anything, at least on very minor things. I'd stay away from interacting with the state as much as possible. But like you said, sometimes when there's a real big thing going down, sometimes you might have to, especially to protect yourself legally.
Yeah. So there's the world we live in and the world we want to live in. And I'm trying to make it more towards the former.
And, yeah.
So that's it.
So thanks for, pretty much introducing yourself here. You can find us at, I forget our Twitter handle already. Let me just get that real quick. I do include it in the show notes. I'm going to throw you out there in the show notes for Pat. And let's see. You can find us, I believe, at Pennsylvania Pat at Twitter. I'm just going to, yep. And you can find us on Instagram at Pennsylvania Patriots Podcast. And let's actually get rolling with the show here. It's pretty much just going to be, like I said, a meet and greet, loosely organized, ask anything. So I figured our first topic would be I like talking about it. I'm a huge gun guy. I don't know about you, Pat. Some guys view them pretty much exclusively as tools that enjoy guns. Me, myself, I'm a big firearms collector. But I also have guns that, you know, I enjoy having, but they also have just a purely utilitarian use, and that is the bullpup AR-15 that you drop it. And no, we're not. I'm not going to get into that.
Jesus.
Yeah, you drop that. Bam, just goes off. But we're not actually gonna that was a joke. I'm not that.
You know, I owned a P90 before, which was a bullpup design, and I fucking loved it. I loved it, everything about it. The only reason I got rid of it was I heard case study after case study that people were shooting a threat with that gun, and the rounds were just, I guess, too hot or something, or they didn't tumble. So someone would, you know, approach you and they'd run towards you and you'd shoot them again and again and again with that 5.7 round and not much would happen. So
I guess the whole purpose of the P90 was to be a bullet hose. And since, you know, in the United States of so-called freedom, we can't have the bullet hose version. So I guess the whole point of the 5.7 round isn't being used to its potential. But I guess that's why. I was always heard compared to just a 22 Magnum, just a little bit hotter.
I've heard that too, yeah.
Which I think it's a really cool gun, but I just can't see, for my practical uses, I can't see the P90 as being, you know, it'd be a fun range toy if I ever wanted to go and spend the money on one. But as a utilitarian firearm, nah, I don't see a practical use of it. Unless, you know, you are in, you know, some kind of SWAT team or something where you can utilize that very high fire rate that
and a short barrel, because that's kind of the whole point too.
True. Yeah, you have a super compact gun with a zipping fast little round that is just an angry pack of hornets coming out of it, and us civilians can't really own that. So, although I wish we could.
Since we're kind of ad-libbing today, you know what fucking hit me yesterday? It's kind of a duality. Yes, the government has access to way different tech and way different types of weapons and tools and vehicles and all that shit and technology than we do as civilians. However, but there are so many fucking civilian shooters that have better guns than the people that are responding to help them.
Yeah. You look at the average competitive shooter with their AR-15 versus, you know, just your standard M4 that you get issued in the military. It's miles ahead. Not only the build quality, but the parts and accessories that you
put. And the reliability and the cleanliness and the, I mean, there's no wear and tear or minimal if it's maintained right.
Yeah. Like the people, you know, the gun that you're issued in the military is pretty much just a basic AR that you'd pick up, you know. I mean, it's got that Colt roll stamp on it and they got some of the better parts on it. I don't know if M4s have cold hammer forge barrels or not. I know the FNs do. Like the what gun is that? The FN version.
Oh, the SCAR?
Not the SCAR, it's their AR series. I know their barrels are cold hammer forged as well. Hmm. But regardless, like, you know, just the normal fit and finish and the parts that you get in, you know, your basic M4 in the military is pretty much just a base level AR that you'd pick up off the shelf. So little food for thought there. My gun is far from Gucci, but it does have some good components on it that make it worth for me at least. So I guess I'll just talk about my rifle. I don't know if you have yours with you or not.
Yeah, I got mine. Go ahead.
Mine's a Frankenstein parts build, just a standard Arrow lower, Magpul furniture, slimline. I really like that series. Just the slimline stock with the grip. Angle foregrip on it. I personally like that. I personally do thumb over bore, and I like to get my hand out as far as possible when handling my weapon. I know some guys really like to do the magwell grip or something of that nature, a little closer to it, but I don't know what you would prefer since have you actually been in any firefights or when you were in Coastie?
I luckily have not been in any firefights, but I've pointed my real gun with real bullets at real bad guys plenty of times and had to make that don't shoot decision quite often.
So you're pretty much as good as anybody without actually pulling the trigger, which you should set up your rifle to be like.
Yeah, that's unique too. A lot of people don't understand that in the training world. That, I mean, it's really easy on Twitter and Instagram to go, why would I train with you? You never shot anybody. But you have professional killers. You got SEALs and Rangers and Delta and all these guys who may have never shot anybody in their life. And then they start a training company and you go, yep, I'll train with them. But then you throw out that little jab at people that have never been in shooting combat. So it's just a unique take that there's a little bit of blindedness that some people sometimes get caught up in.
Yeah.
Not to mention that with simunitions now, you have what's called pre-combat veterans. So you spend enough time in that shoot house with those simunition rounds and you learn a lot of lessons that other people just never get the chance to learn.
That is something that I've always wanted to do. But then I looked up the cost of courses and I'm like, man, that is really expensive.
If you have my opinion on that is if you have a gun and you have ammo, stop everything. Don't spend any more fucking money. Save up that money and go to a force on force class. Even if it's expensive, you gotta fucking do that at least once.
You know what? I'm thinking I might take your advice up on that.
I promise you I wouldn't steer you wrong, at least not on purpose, but I wouldn't buy a second gun or a third gun or a new sight or a bipod or any of that shit before you know what it's like to try and apply that shit while rounds are coming back at you.
Because they have all these Gucci accessories, which mine really doesn't. I built mine to be as minimalist as possible to get with.
Oh, amen, bro.
But I believe that needs to get done. The only thing I don't have, which I will be getting, is a weapons light, at least for my AR. Now, my carry gun, well, that is coming as well. After just listening, you know, I've held off and held off, and, you know, I'm just finally just going to do it because even I don't have any personal experience on it, but even just a force multiplier as a light would really, really help in certain situations.
I do the same thing. So I've got my, I have a Springfield Armory Saint, and it's the Victor model, the Saint Victor. And they have a AR pistol platform and just a regular rifle platform. I have the regular rifle length. And I went 5.56, which I'm fine with just because it's in this crazy fucking world now. You can still get ammo for it. And I did the same thing. I liked it because it's lightweight. I liked it because the company has a pretty reliable platform. So I'm pretty fucking sure that when I pull the trigger, it's going to go bang. And I have flip-up sights. I have a Surefire Mini Scout Pro light on it. I changed out my stock to shave a few more ounces off the stock. And I'm running with a idea that I call inches and ounces. And it's not my phrase. I stole that from Blue Force Gear. I try and be as minimalist as possible with few exceptions. But if you are a minimalist, it allows you to take that one unique twist that you have in your life to add into it. And still have the space and the room for it. So I got a light, I got pop-up sights, and the only thing I have left is I'm going to get a really lightweight red dot and a can on the end, and I'm all set.
I have my can. Well, mine's, I'm just making a 9mm can out of a solvent trap because I did not want to wait almost a year at this point just to get my gun muffler. So, you know, I got my I believe it's form one. Yeah, it's a form one that you need to fill out for the to make your own. So I don't know what gun I'm going to put it on yet. I have a few 9mm guns that'll work, and I don't know if it'll handle 5.56. I might give it a try, but the way mine is set up, just to describe, if you want to copy my build, which, you know, it's not a Noveski or, you know, Knight, which I don't know. I personally don't know. If those guns are really worth the money or if you're really just paying for the name because of the military contracts. Mine's just an HM defense upper with that HMB bolt. You know, I bought it, thought it would be a good deal. And it's got the features that I like for it, the nickel bar on bolt head. I don't know if some people prefer that for the bolt carrier themselves. It's a monoblock barrel. There is a gas block on it, but it's not keyed in. It's machined into the barrel itself. So the gas tube is removable in case you'd ever have to do that. I've never known really of any direct impingement AR of the gas tube failing besides in those, I guess, the Magnum videos, the meltdowns that IV88 has done. I don't know if you've seen them or not. That's really the only time I've ever seen a gas tube fail on an AR. I don't know if that's something that you should be worried to about or not. What would be your take on it? You're saying it is direct impingement, right? Or is that a piston gun?
I believe it's it is not a piston gun.
So just standard little stainless tube on top.
Yes.
I don't know what muzzle brake HM Defense has on it. It's a 1-7, or it might actually be a 1-8. Yeah, it's a 1-8 223 Wild. I don't get in the real technicalities of the chamberings. You know, I was always told just go 5.56 NATO, and you should be good for pretty much anything, especially for a fighting rifle. I have mine set up, I wouldn't say close quarters, maybe about an intermediate range, so maybe 400 yards max, which in all reality, that's pretty much what you're going to be using your rifle for anyway, should you ever have to use it. So, like I said, I got that Magpul AFG on it, just the plastic Magpul sights. I might switch them out for more durable metal, but they're meant for backups anyway in case my optic fails, which I use a Vortex Spitfire for mine. I really like the prism sights, probably because my eyes suck with red dots. I always get that hazy blob. I don't know if you have any experience with that or all, like with your EOTechs or aim points or anything like that.
I've shot for years with EOTechs, and I just fucking love them. I love the big, wide, flat, square glass. I like the huge field of view. I like that there's a ring on the outside around that center dot, so it's much quicker to, like when you go from the lure ready up to your eyes, it's much quicker to acquire that middle dot. I'm also really focused on low weight, and I know those EOTechs are big hunking monsters on top of guns.
They are. This one's pretty much similar to the size and weight of it's just a really tiny one magnification scope. That's pretty much all this is with the Spitfire AR. I just like it that the reticule is etched in the glass. It's nice and crisp. It does illuminate red and green, different brightness settings. I haven't had any issues with it. That being said, I haven't been in an actual gunfight and I haven't abused the shit out of it, so I really, that's just how I would put it. Maybe one day I get like a nice aim point or an EOTech. I think they're great. I do like the EOTechs, but just building this out, I'm like, it's kind of a lot at the moment. I guess you could say it's, I don't know, to be honest with you. I'm happy with mine, and I think that's all that really matters, in my opinion.
I agree, right there with you.
And the last thing, which is the most important piece of gear that you should have on your rifle anyway, is a damn decent sling.
Yes, absolutely.
I use just the Magpul MS1 sling with that quick, you know, you can loosen it and tighten it with, you know, one hand, just zip, zip. I personally like to use a Israeli style just over my neck. One point of contact with my body itself. And then you obviously have your support hand and your shoulder. So I just like that so you can bring it up quick. And then if you need to use the sling as stability, you can pull that tight with your hand. So when I'm carrying the gun, I keep it high and tight. And then if I would need to use it, I just pull on the little Magpul tab. Well, I wouldn't say tab. It's like a slider, and it just quick adjusts it like that. So obviously I use standard round 30 mags. From what I've seen, the reliability of the high capacity in quotes, but you know, the 40, 50, 60 rounders, besides that, the Magpul drum and the X products drums, I don't like the possibility of having that much weight on your gun on top of the high probability of failure rate. I find that unacceptable.
I did have a friend tell me he recently started using, the dual magazine clips. It clips like a fresh mag adjacent to your current mag.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I think Magpul makes a little thing that you can do that. You can clip two P mags together and do that. There's a couple other brands that do that.
I might consider that. I don't know.
That actually seems like be a good compromise between, you know, a drum and just a standard mag, because you have the reliability, but you still have the weight of the drum and the capacity. So I guess like everything in the world, especially when it comes to guns, it's all compromises. What are you willing to sacrifice to complete the objective or build your rifle with the task at hand?
Another word. So I also have a friend, T-Rex Shenanigans. He runs his own blog. He did a course recently with a big name in the gun industry, and they really hammered home the idea of two-point slings and the fact that a sling is a really, really useful tool that not a lot of people take advantage of. I have a single-point sling for this. The only problem is when I wore, you know, my armor and my gun belt and I had a weapons catch, a single-point sling made perfect sense. So if I let my rifle drop, it's high, it's tight, it's like hanging on my actual chest, not kind of down by my dick. And when I sling it back behind me, it goes right into the catch on my belt, like a big C-clamp back there that grabs the forend.
So it just keeps your hot barrel and everything else from flopping around. And
yeah, and then you have an open and closed system where you can temporarily let the rifle kind of hang in that catch, not really secure, or you can take an extra Velcro strap and strap the rifle in when you're doing shit like climbing a ladder or whatever. So now that I don't wear body armor, I just have a home defense rifle. It doesn't make a lot of sense to have that single point just flopping around by my kneecaps and my balls and the backs of my legs. So I might switch it over to a double point sling or a 2-point sling.
Yeah, that's currently what I run, the 2-point, but I have it tight enough I can use it as a single point. Like I said, Israeli style, where it just goes around the back of your neck. And then when you need to bring it up, you do that. And if you need more length, you just pull on that quick adjust. And there you go. You have it set to whatever you need. I personally run P-Mags and Hex Mags. I haven't had a single issue with them. I don't know if you just run aluminum GI Mags or...
I run MagBolt Mags.
Do you have any bad experiences with just the normal Stanags that you were issued?
I had a lot of bad experience with military magazines to the point where every second round would end up being a misfire because of the feed lips or the feed ramp lips, whatever you call them, on the top of the magazine. If you drop your mag, which you're supposed to, if you drop those shitty punch metal magazines and that feed lip or that detention lip, whatever you call it, hits the ground first and it bends a little bit, every second round that goes through your gun ends up jamming or failure to fire, failure to feed, whatever. So I like to teach the newer guys in my squad. I tell them, hey, if you have a magazine issue and there's a bend in it, the bureaucracy wants you to test it and identify it and turn it in and then request a new one. However, that same bureaucracy will go, let me see that magazine. Oh, it works pretty good. You're good. You're fine. So I would teach them, if you have any fucking problems with any of your magazines, don't request a new one, because if you have one that kind of works, you can't get a new one. So you take one and you fucking demolish it. And then you bring all the parts to the gunners and you go, hey, I need a new one. Because then you have to have one that at least is not in pieces. So we take it, I teach them to drop it on the ground, stomp on it, throw it, smash it, bend it, so it's irreparable, so that you can save your own life and someone else's life, because the bureaucracy has a big disconnect between what they ask us to do and what they support us in doing.
So the bureaucracy itself is willing to spend a whole bunch of money training you and spending millions of dollars equipping you to be the super warrior, but won't spend $6 a mag to keep it.
Not only would they not spend the money on good magazines, we were punished for having magazines that had a perfect usage rate and a zero failure rate.
According to the rules, you couldn't go and buy P-Mags, Hex-Mags, Lancers, anything of that are known to have a very good track record.
Yeah, ones that you can run over with vehicles, and you can easily take them apart and clean them and maintain them. Yeah, we were incentivized to set ourselves up for failure. So what happens is, of course, for every single rule in a bureaucracy, for every single policy that you implement, there is an unforeseen policy on the back end that humans will implement on workarounds and corner cutting and rule breaking. So what we did is we used all aluminum magazines on the day that we checked our gear before deployment. So someone went over all of our gear cases and our weapons and our systems, and they did all their checks in the boxes, and they said, all right, close up all your gear. You're good for deployment tomorrow. So we closed up our gear and they walked away. And then we all opened up our gear, took our aluminum or whatever magazines out, threw them in a closet somewhere in the gear room, and put all of our P-Mags back into the case and deployed. It's so weird. It's such a weird system.
So basically just pencil whipping. It was the main concern of the armory and the bureaucracy, according to that, which you just described.
Yeah, it's so weird. Yep. And
check the box, you're good to go.
Me and Matt from Status Quo Pod, we did an episode recently on before you join the military, what you should know. And it wasn't supposed to be like a libertarian wet dream. It wasn't supposed to be like, hey, here's all the terrible shit. But so much of it is, here's the things they don't tell you. There is a system. The system is in place. The system is designed that you lose and they win. Like just like the gun stuff we just talked about. That's the exact design of the system. There is no, like, you don't come in and say, hey, boss, I found these really cool magazines that have a really good success rate. Your boss doesn't go, oh, let me send that up the chain of command. That sounds great. What they do is they go, shut up. I don't want to hear it. I don't have time for it. Don't bring it up again.
So
instead of innovating, military does the opposite and they punish you. It's weird, man. I wish that's one of the main goals of this website and this project, this lifelong project I have now of Uncensored Tactical. One of those main goals is to tell the public the good, the bad, and the ugly of what happens behind the scenes. And unfortunately, most of it is bad and ugly.
Unfortunately, yes. I don't have any. Well, I have experience with bureaucracies within my own company. I just work for.
Of course, yeah.
And that's everywhere you go. You know, it's like the disconnect with the trades. You know, you have the corporate side, the bean counters, and then you have the guys that actually get the work done. And there's just a giant disconnect where the bean counters are concerned about their budget, but yet the guys out on the floor don't have the proper tools to do the job and then get in trouble when they have to make the tools or make something work that goes against policy.
Yep. It's weird. It's a weird beast. And bureaucracy has a lot of things that are similar, whether it's government or military or private sector. A lot of things carry over from one to another.
I've noticed that. I can't. Well, I'm not at liberty to discuss the my friends that work for certain government contractors in my area.
Of course.
Well, I can tell you they work at BAA Systems and Johns Controls and another place that makes nuclear reactor components for submarines and stuff like that. I am in South Central Pennsylvania, so if you would know what those two companies are in their proximity, you can kind of estimate on my location, but that's besides the point.
So let me follow up a little bit here. Whether you're government bureaucracy or private bureaucracy, there's a lot of things that carry over, probably 90% of it. However, in private bureaucracy, if you don't accept government contracts and you are a truly close to like truly private company, your incentive still has to be to make money. The incentives in a government bureaucracy are that if you fail, you get more money. So there's a lot of things in the operation of it, like, hey, how do we pass information? How do we train people? How do we test people? How do we track their progress? How do we manage them? A lot of those things are all the same. But the financial incentives for a government bureaucracy and the financial incentives for a mostly private bureaucracy are wildly different still. And I have a theory that, unfortunately, you can't test it, but I have a theory that in a truly free market, meaning zero regulations, zero licensing, zero zoning restrictions, zero local government, zero taxes, flat zero across the board, I have a feeling that all those same principles of how you operate a bureaucracy, I feel like they would almost all disappear. If you truly were only able to exist if you were in the positive, like the net positive, I think a lot of that bureaucratical bullshit would go away. I think that so much of it, even if it's not directly related to government or directly related to regulation, it's almost indirectly related to that. And it forces you to do things in your business that have nothing to do with bringing value. It only has to do with regulation. So still, you can't test it. But for now, whether you're government or semi-government or private company, private in quotes, because you still need to pay the government and regulate yourself, a lot of it's so much of the same.
Very interesting there, Pat.
That's my next book is going to be on bureaucracy.
Yeah, I heard about that yesterday when you were on the Fadcast.
On the Fadcast. I love those guys.
Yeah, they are. I want to get on with those guys, and they're open for it, especially Carr. But, like, man, how do I fit in with that? Like, they're do I have the intellect and philosophy background that they like to implement a lot on there? And I'm like, man, am I going to be even on the same wavelength as those guys?
They are, without a doubt, my second favorite podcast to listen to.
Oh, I love listening to it, but I'm like, man, if I'm put on the spotlight, I'm just going to, my brain's just going to be like,
That's all right. Make more episodes, brother.
Exactly. So we forgot to actually plug, we committed the mortal sin of not saying what we're drinking tonight. Well, today. We should have done that at the beginning. Me personally, I have a sampler of just local beers, IPAs, and my favorite that I got at my local grocery store. Just picked up a little six-pack for it. I just finished drinking I'm a huge fan of Angry Orchard. I usually go with their crisp apple, but I tried their pear, and I really enjoyed that. And then I have the green apple. I'm not drinking all this right now because I still have stuff to do with the day, so I'm only just going to stick with two.
Just two.
Yeah. I got my Troganator IPA. I'm not a huge fan of IPAs. There's only three or four that I really like. I really like Dogfish Head, Trogues, which is a local brewery in Pennsylvania, and any Baltimore and Maryland guys would know Heavy Steez Brewer, Heavy Seas. All their stuff is pretty good, in my opinion. And after finishing that pair, I'm just going to finish this Sam Adams Cherry Wheat, and that's pretty much all I'm going to be drinking today. What about you, Pat?
I have this Larceny whiskey.
I've heard of that. I've heard very good things about that.
I've had it before, and then I heard about it again. Pete Raymond was on, I think, Fadcast, or they were on Pete Raymond's show, I forget, but they were doing a double show. And Pete was like, yeah, this whiskey is so good. And I'm like, shit, I haven't had that in a while. So I went out and bought some Larceny, and I'm doing Larceny and ginger ale. And I have these cool ice cube molds that do the like the clear square ice cubes.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just enjoying some whiskey and ginger ale in a coffee mug.
That's actually, thank you for introducing me to that. I was listening to one of your earlier episodes, and you were just speaking about your whiskey and ginger ale. And I'm like, what the hell is that? I've never heard of that. I would always just have like a whiskey and Coke, straight whiskey, or, you know, just something like that. And now it's actually my favorite drink. I absolutely love it. I personally like Bullet Bourbon with the Canada Dry Bold.
I don't know if I've had Bullet yet. I think I'll try that one next.
If you really like it's a real spicy ginger. It hits you pretty good, but it's really good, in my opinion. I love ginger ale, and then you introduced me to that, and so thank you very much for that.
Yeah.
So after we discuss our usual semi-alcoholism that every podcast has, I was just going to move into kit. You obviously got your rifle. That's pretty much the main focus of your kit, but you also have these little auxiliary pieces of equipment that, since I went with a low weight rifle build, I was going to go with a minimalist kit. And obviously, just a disclaimer, none of my equipment is going to be ever used for any offensive purpose whatsoever. It is purely defensive. I hope I would never actually have to use it, and I hope that's the mentality that everyone should have with it. You know, you have it, and you always hope that you'll never need it. It's just like a fire extinguisher, in my opinion.
I have my kit down in my car, but I've got just a ceramic plates with a Eagle carrier. Eagle Industries makes some Molly armor carriers. The kit itself is really thin, slimline. And I have swimmer's plates, so they're not the big rectangles. They're kind of really angled on top, so I can punch my arms forward if I have to.
That's exactly what I have. I know I might get some flack for it. I don't know why. Hoplite has gotten like a really mixed reputation. personally. I really like the guy, at least the guy that owns it. What's his name? Lyman Bishop. I don't know. He was a really good guy. I talked to him on the phone for over an hour just deciding what I wanted, and he really helped me out. And I had never had a problem with him. I ordered my plates. The plates got here at a pretty reasonable time, and then this COVID shit went down. And, you know, my carrier took a while to get here, but, you know, after receiving it, I haven't – you know, I was very impressed with it. I use Hoplite Level 4 Swimmer's Cut. I forget the exact number, but – I personally like ceramic a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I've worn steel and I'm like, man, this is just seems like it's unnecessarily heavy because it's, you know, solid 3/8 steel.
Yeah, it is. Back. It's a weird, even though they're thinner than ceramics, they're just fucking heavy.
I mean, yeah, you got the multi-hit capability, but I went with ceramic because of the weight and the spall protection that it has. Cause I don't care what you say, that anti-spall coating on armor plates is, I mean, it might be good for one or two rounds, but I don't like that. I would rather not have a hole in me, but I don't want to catch, you know, fragments of the bullet jacket in my neck while I'm getting hit as well. So I don't have a hole in me, but now my neck has been turned to hamburger meat. So does it really help you out a whole lot?
Fair point.
And my carrier is just a rogue carrier that Hoplite offers. It has Molly points on it, but I'm not going to use it for that because I have an H harness that goes over that. And on the left side of my harness, I keep 5 spare mags loaded. My right side, I keep 2 spare pistol mags. My sidearm that I run in a drop leg is just a Beretta 92.
That's a great gun.
Yeah, I've heard a few of my friends in the military said they're all junk. And I could, that's probably because the ones that they were issued before the M17 was adopted was, you know, a 30-year-old Beretta that was adopted in the 80s and had thousands of rounds put through it, not maintained, and then it's all clapped out, and they want to call all Berettas junk.
Even the ones I had that were fairly worn in were really, really great shooting guns.
Oh, yeah. It is quite possibly, out of all the duty handguns, the Beretta, in my opinion, besides, like, the Browning High Power, is probably the smoothest shooting one I've ever experienced. I can't give enough praises for mine. Now, my Beretta 92 is an Inox. It's stainless and shiny, but, you know, it's the same exact thing as what you would get with just a normal 92 FS. And then in my drop, I keep 1 mag in my sidearm, ready to go, 2 spare mags on the right side of my carrier. I keep a bigger mag light, and actually a flare pouch. It just managed to fit perfectly on my right side of the carrier. Even though I'm going to have a weapons light on my rifle, it's still nice just to have that that flashlight should you ever need it. Mm-hmm. And then I'm also having IFAC on the left side near my chest. I don't know if I should reorient that or not. Just has all your standard equipment that comes with that. So I tried to build it as light as possible with as minimal stuff as possible to get you through what you need to do. It's not a survivalist setup, even though I want to make a go bag that is meant for me to, should I ever need it, I could go out and live a while on the tools and equipment that I would have in there. Are you a big thing on go bags, or are you more of like a hunker in place, have the equipment that you need should you need to use it in a short amount of time?
I had the phrase hammered into me a lot, which was your kit and your gear is always alive. It should always be alive and always changing. That's with the changes in budget, changes in new technology, new tools that come to the market, new ideas, new techniques that you implement that has gear that supports it. So, it's tough to manage so much, especially on, you know, limited budget and limited time, but I probably prep for maybe one or two response types at a time. So currently a big issue for me would be, I don't like jumping on the highway and driving 3 or 4 hours from home without having a long gun with me. And I think that is a completely rational stance as a human in the US in 2020. I don't think there is anything crazy about that. So for me, it's kind of a road bag. And it's not to, you know, to hike home 300 miles across the state. And it's not to hold off the zombies, but it's for a limited engagement. And it's also, believe it or not, so much of my preparedness now is for creature features. So we don't get a lot of snowstorms in Florida, but it gets really fucking hot. If you're staying at a hotel or you're staying at a friend's place or you're staying in your car, like let's say the highway system on both sides of Florida is pretty limited. So you can get stuck. If there's a really, really bad accident, it's really common to sit in your vehicle for 6+ hours on the highway before you can get to an exit.
Oh, really?
Like parked, especially on the west coast of Florida, where there's a lot more bridges and like kind of peninsula formations with bridges and peninsulas. And there's really only a dual highway system. So if one of them's blocked up, the other one takes all the heat, and then that gets blocked up too. So for things like that, it's, can I sleep in my car? Do I have some water? Do I have a rifle in case shit gets weird? Believe it or not, binoculars are a really good piece of kit that I keep in all my vehicles, and they live in the vehicle. So not that it's super duper tactical, like I'm going to use it in a SWAT team raid, but if you're anywhere near like the peak of a bridge or the peak of like an exit and you're stuck, it's really good to kind of maybe park that car on the side, or if you know you're not going anywhere, just get out, climb on top of your car, get those binoculars out. It is a huge tool that you can use to gather information, even in traffic, right? So let's say you're at a large intersection with like you're in a city, you're driving around a city, but there's like four lanes going through this light and four lanes coming the other way, and there are four lanes on each side. So it's basically eight lanes wide on all corners.
Mm-hmm.
And someone does something really weird diagonally all the way across the intersection, and you see someone get out of their car, or you see someone like walk over to a car, and you're like, you know, that's odd. It's really nice to reach your right hand back and grab those binoculars and go, what are they really doing? Oh shit. Or, oh, they're fine.
Yeah.
So it's a really great piece of kit to keep. The other thing I prepare for besides highway travel is just people coming into the house. So I have no kids in the house, so I have nothing to worry about with gun safety besides me.
Mm-hmm.
So I keep my rifle close to the bed where I like it. I keep my light source on my rifle. I have a sling that is already attached. It goes right over my neck. I have my bump bag, which I did a whole episode on, which is if someone knocks on the door kind of midday, I can grab my pistol and walk to the door. That's easy. If I hear something, like I hear a commotion going on outside the house, my gear that supports that is I grab the rifle, I go to the window, I take a look. If I hear someone trying to make an entry into my home, and I think like if it's going to be imminent, like I have 3 seconds, I grab the rifle. If it's, hey, someone's like tinkering around at my front door, okay, I take a deep breath, I reach under my bed, I pull a parachute bag out, and it's already unzipped, and I put my feet into my boots, I pull my pants that are wrapped around my boots, I pull my pants up, I do a quick clip, I put my Glock on my hip, and I grab my rifle, and I consider whether or not I want to grab my armor out of that bag too or not. And now I can slowly, smoothly, and calmly, and with more confidence, respond to something if I have that time. So those are basically the two things I prepare for now, is highway travel and home invasion. And my gear is designed to support that.
That's a very good explanation about what you're doing. I might have to really consider. I did remember your episode on that bag idea. You know, you just have your boots there. You know, it's not meant for creature comfort. It's, you know, you got to get some shoes on, and you know, just hop up, clip, and go. Because it's better than running around your house barefoot, especially if someone decides to bust out a window in your in your dwelling. You don't want to be walking on broken feet, or you know, have to go out into the yard, all that.
Oh, I'm sorry, man. I was catching my breath.
That's all right. My go bag is mainly just, I really like Kenai. Their prices aren't bad, and they're made in America, not that it matters. But I remember the build quality is very good. So in that comes with a little water bladder, should you need. Also, big thing is keep that thing clean. You really need to.
Yes.
you know, it comes with an inline filter, but still push some kind of disinfectant through it, even just, you know, diluted bleach water just to clean out that bag. Another thing that you could do is fill that with distilled water so you know that it's just pure clean water, nothing in there that could really grow to begin with. And if you're really, really amenable, do you put a couple drops of iodine in there just to make sure that it's good and clean? It's not going to taste good, but it will keep you hydrated.
Yeah, water's a big one. I use a Berkey countertop filter at my house and everything.
Yeah, I really need to get one of those because I've heard nothing but praises with you with one of them.
They're worth every penny. And then if you have the space for it, I would buy the size that's bigger than what you think you need instead of what's smaller than you think you need. Just because it's not water on demand like an installed inline filter would be. So if you wake up and you have forgotten to fill it and you're like, all right, I'm going to get my day started. Let me have a cup of water. And you get like a half inch of water in your cup. You're like, fuck. You have to go back to that thing and
fill it back up.
Fill it all the way back up and wait. So that's the only downside. So when you have a larger one, you can go longer between filling up the top reservoir. But it's nice because it's no batteries. It's gravity operated. There's no moving parts. And I've interviewed the, I think it's Jeff Gleason who runs directive21.com, I think is where I got mine from. Customer service is fantastic. He's very knowledgeable about the product. From what he says, I'm no scientist, but he says the amount of clean water that comes through is fucking amazing. So he says you can go out to the lake behind your house and like scoop up some water and pour it right in. And he's like, and it's going to taste exactly the same as the shit that comes out of your faucet that goes through your Berkey. So I love it. Not to mention, yeah, the firefight's important. Yeah, the gear's important. But shit like, let's talk about this bureaucracy again. If something happens to the water supply, whether it's local, like to your house or local to your neighborhood or local to your city, and you're drinking that dirty water, the government doesn't go, oh no, we dropped a drop of dirty stuff into the water. Let's notify everybody. Let's fix it before it gets to their faucets. That's not what happens.
No, people it's already contaminated, and then they tell you, hey, you probably shouldn't drink your water.
So people start getting sick, and then they go to the hospital, if they go to the hospital. So there's already a lag time of all that water getting pushed to everybody's faucet. And then there's a lag time of how long does it take you to drink that and then get sick. Then there's a lag time of should I go to the hospital or not? Then there's a lag time of all these different doctors going, huh, that's odd. And then all the meetings and all the phone calls, and then calling the government and getting them involved and going, well, we need to make an announcement. They don't go, oh, hey, everybody. They go, okay, well, how do we format this? So all these different lag points between there's still people drinking dirty water. What are you going to do about it? So having that Berkey is really nice. So by the time that boil water advisory goes out, you already know that you're drinking clean water the whole time. And I take the fluoride out of mine too. I got the extra fluoride filters. And I don't know all the science. Again, I'm not a chemist or a scientist or a
your filter might just be just reverse osmosis, I believe, if it's like no mechanical or electrical or anything like that. Because that's what we have in line with our water tap is because we have very hard water where we live. So we just installed a reverse osmosis to the kitchen faucet. And if you want decent drinking water, well, you get it out of the fridge too if you want it cold. But if you just want decent cleaning water, you get the reverse osmosis. But now that you mentioned that Berkey filter, should the power go out and we lose water pressure at our house, you still have that filter there that you can just dump any old water that you want in there.
Great.
So I'm going to have to really put that on my shopping list and really invest in one of them. And I guess another big thing of your preparedness would, I guess, be you called it apartment studying, I guess you would say,
mm-hmm.
Or self-reliance in a short-term emergency.
So the homesteading idea is how do you make your property work for you? Right? Mm. How do you become more self-sufficient, self-reliant? Apartment steading is tough. You obviously cannot feed yourself on a garden balcony.
Obviously, the wait time is too much and the plants just won't yield anything to actually survive you.
Of course. But you can lower your grocery bill from a garden, from an apartment garden. I used to make a lot of meals with basil in them. I make fresh homemade basil pesto at home.
I've heard that it was amazing.
Oh, so good.
You're going to have to send me that recipe because I've been wanting
easy.
To.
Easy. I would have, be happy to. It's really easy. So when we go to the store, basil's fucking expensive. I don't know if you know this. So you can buy a whole potted plant of basil for, I don't know, 10, 15, something like that, dollars. And I take it home. I rip all the leaves off. I put them in the recipe. I throw the pot away. Well, if I make basil, I don't know, once every month, that's $15 a month plus the grocery trip. If I plant my own basil, all it fucking costs me once I'm established is water. So for all intents and purposes, let's call that free. So for free now, I've taken all those different $10, $15 grocery trips to buy basil or more if they're out of the potted plants and all they have is like the specialty organic small servings of like prepackaged full leaves of basil. Those are expensive as shit. That's like $8 or $9 for like 10 leaves. So I have to buy like three of those packets, which is close to $30 or $40 just for making homemade pesto. So do that multiple times a year, take that math and take all that fucking money you spend all year and then reduce it down to zero if I grow basil on the balcony. So I'm not a homesteader, but I'm doing what I can to kind of lower my grocery bill, become a little more self-sufficient, save a little more money. And then if you have land, you can do things like you can let people store their horses on your land and they pay you money just to let the horses graze your land. And like, if you have a stable, right? An apartment can't exactly do that. You could dog sit for people. You can certainly do that, especially if you don't own any pets or especially if your apartment is pet friendly or if you do own one and you already pay to have a dog in your apartment, it's easy to have another one, you know, babysat for a week. So understanding the differences between how you can make more money within your apartment and how you can store things better and more appropriately and better uses of storage. God, that's really a big one. Organization and storage. I mean, because you can't store a pallet of MREs in an apartment. And I don't think you should either.
No. Like you said, it has to make your life better, not necessarily change your living style. Mm-hmm. So just small incremental changes that will help you out in the long run that doesn't necessarily change the way you live.
Right. I'm looking at it right now from across the room. You want to sleep better in a house, you can structure how, you know, you can build a big shutter outside the window. You can put wind up hurricane shutters there. You can put outdoor like swing, like the wooden slats that go over your windows that swing outward. You can do stuff like that in an apartment. Or you go online, you get this, I think it's Easy Curtains or Easy Blackout, I think you call it, the letter E, the letter Z blackouts. Because my work schedule often changes with the podcast, I got Velcro on complete dark blackout shades for my apartment. So when you're looking into the apartment, all you see is a, you know, like a white, almost looks like a curtain. But on my side, it's completely black. So stuff like that, like just understanding what you can do with limited options in a smaller space. I love that, man. I'm definitely going to resume that content over on Insurgency Knitting Circle with Texas Joe.
Fantastic. So let's talk about food storage. I've been having a problem recently.
Yeah.
I like stocking up on pasta and our canned goods. We have two shelves, mainly because there's really not a lot of storage in our house. The pantry was converted. Well, not converted. When the house was built, the pantry was replaced with a washer and dryer in the kitchen. But it's kind of in the kitchen. It's hard to describe. It's a modular layout. So we could have made a big walk-in pantry or put the washer and dryer upstairs, and that's what was opted in for. So we store a lot of our stuff down the basement on a metal shelf that we got at like Sam's Club, Costco, whatever you would prefer. And then upstairs we have another shelf that's like for bulk spices and pasta, canned goods, stuff like that. I've been having an issue actually with my pasta being stored. Is there really, how do I put it? After it sits for a couple months, we're having to throw it out because when we look at it to use it, there the eggs of weevils have hatched in there. And
yeah.
So
I've had that before.
Yeah. And it's really infuriating because you buy this stuff hoping to keep it for longer and it's only good for a couple months. So would you know of any way to store that unless you consider storing bulk flour and like, I guess, vacuum sealing it or a way of preserving it so that those eggs don't hatch. And unfortunately that's just what you have to do with flour and grain storage is that those eggs are in there, kind of a disgusting little fact. But
Sure. So anytime we store sugar or flour or yeast in this apartment, we do a double seal. So any bags of flour that will come home from the store immediately go into a Ziploc bag, like a gallon size Ziploc bag, like the whole sack of flour, like the paper folded bag. That whole product, we just pick up the whole product, set it into a Ziploc bag, and then seal it shut. So it's like kind of one and a half seals. It's not really two. So we take that and we put it in the cupboard, and we only have one open at a time. Our yeast, because we cook bread a lot, like homemade fresh bread at home a lot too. And if the power goes out, or if even if it's like, God, we're doing it now, even if there's a stay-at-home order, right? Or if you're sick, or you're stuck at home for 2 weeks, let alone your health. Like when you make homemade bread, that shit's so much more healthy than the sliced white bread you get at the store. So we use a lot of yeast here, and we keep it in a rubber gasket sealed, those jars that are glass, and you fold the glass lid over top, and you crank that like metal wire crank, and it like
Oh,
seals it
yeah.
shut. So we keep our yeast in that inside the fridge. So it's that's almost again a double layer. So all of our flour, sugar, stuff like that is all double sealed. For pasta, I haven't done it yet, but I'm going to. So when you're t you can store flour for a long time. Eggs, if you get them locally, or if you travel, you might not even have to have the eggs, but even if there's a disaster, you can probably still go a block or two or three, or go just outside city limits. And if you have a relationship and you've consistently bought eggs from someone that produces them locally, you can
Yeah,
still
we
get
don't have
those.
to worry about our egg
Yeah, great.
situation personally because we have chickens and actually we have an overflow of eggs that we don't know what to do
Awesome.
with.
God, I'm so jealous.
Yeah,
So if you have
we
that.
just give them away at this point because we only have four chickens, but they're cranking out, half a dozen eggs a day. And I do enjoy my eggs, but not as much as that. So
So I think the recipe for homemade noodles is it's what, eggs, flour, and is there anything else? I can't remember. I think it's,
you just need a little bit of salt, personally. It
yeah,
depends
eggs,
on
flour,
what
salt, I
pasta you're
think.
doing.
So I wanted to get a, I've made homemade noodles before in an apartment. It's just tough to get that consistency without a noodle rolling machine.
Yeah, if you have a KitchenAid mixer,
KitchenAid, yeah. So I was going to
you
buy a
can buy that.
KitchenAid. I haven't got to it yet, but you can store those noodles in the freezer for quite a while. So A, it tastes better. B, it just makes me feel like, not to be like happy hippie, but like I feel like I'm in touch with my soul when I'm taking ingredients and I'm making my food, and that I'm storing my food like a responsible human in case something happens. And it makes it easier to cook later. So I take frozen noodles out of the freezer, I let them thaw for a couple minutes, I throw them in the pot, I cook them. Like that, to me, that's a lifestyle change instead of going to the store, buying extra noodles and crossing my fingers. Not that there's anything bad with that, that's good, but to avoid the weevil problem, and just to get a little better flavor, make your own, man. Even in a small place, you can do that.
I'm really gonna have to consider that. That's a fantastic idea. I've made homemade pasta before, and like I said, I enjoy being the little bit of the self-sufficiency kind of type, and that's something that I'm moving a little bit into more and more. Canned goods are obviously a big thing, and I've been
Yeah.
starting to do the copy canning thing where I'm just rotating stock, where I've always have a stockpile of. But since we shop at Sam's Club and well, really all we have is Sam's Club. BJ's a little bit, but not as much. I believe that Sam's Club has a better selection. So we'll just buy a bulk pack of say, 12 cans of beans or tomatoes, and you just run through that stock. But I always keep a few cans in reserve. And then I'll rotate those new cans when I buy another big bulk pack.
Sounds good.
So, just little baby steps like you were saying. What was another thing I was going to talk about? I'm blanking out right now. So we touched a little bit on the self-sufficiency, a little bit about our kit. Is there anything else that you really want to add?
I'm trying to look around just to see if anything inspires me. No, gunfighting is a skill set that, like you said, hopefully we never fucking have to use, but it's important. So I have a series on never owned a gun. It's for people that have never owned a gun. Big surprise. It's kind of, I'm trying to take the myth away from gun ownership.
Oh yeah, and I really enjoyed that series, especially with the new influx of new gun owners right now. And that I don't have a problem with all the new gun owners, including with this ammo and gun shortage. And I'm just wondering, is it all the new gun owners, or is it the typical election year panic buying that you know, people have instilled upon over the past few years. I don't necessarily have an answer to that one, but you know, the new gun owners I don't have an issue with, because the more people that we can get on the more self-sufficiency, protecting yourself, you're responsible for your own safety, the better. But do you think it a little bit also has to play with the people that have guns for a while and never considered, man, I should probably stock up on ammo and, you know, training while I have it. But now, since, you know, the world is devolving as we speak right now, people are finally waking up to it. So what would you think is more to blame with this massive ammo shortage, the new gun owners or the people that are, you know, just finally waking up to it and should have bought ammo and, you know, supplies ahead of time?
I think this one's simple supply and demand. If you scare the shit out of people and you have rioting in the streets, I don't think it's a shock that people are going to, that existing gun owners and new gun owners are both going to flock to the shelves. I don't think that's a surprise. Something that politicians largely don't understand is that products don't appear overnight. You don't just snap your fingers and go, turn the machines back on. We need products. Like, it takes a while.
Even before, when we had the little bit of the Trump slump, when, you know, gun sales weren't as high because, you know, they're all, you know, we have a Republican in Congress, and not that he's pro-gun, but you can't tell certain individuals that. You know, even back then, machines, you know, the equipment for manufacturing the guns and the ammo was already at full capacity, and they can't necessarily make more than what they're making now because it's a huge financial investment just to add another machine, just to say make 9mm. It's, you know, probably millions of dollars, and the companies are just going as fast as they can. So, you know, some people need to understand that, and that's why I'm gonna reiterate, you probably should have, you know, hindsight's always 20/20, but you probably should have prepared ahead of time because you knew something like this was going to happen again. Now, I don't think anybody predicted that it would necessarily pan out like this. I thought it would just be, oh, another election scare. People are going to be, you know, flocking to the gun shelves again because, you know, there's another, I guess, possibility of a Republican not being elected, which I don't necessarily care anymore at this point. I used to be a hard Republican and, you know, really big into that. And then I just kind of woken up my eyes and like, well, they're really all on the side of the same coin.
Yeah. I'm long gone from that system long ago. That's not coming back.
Absolutely. You know, so now I'm just more concerned about, you know, my safety, my family's safety, and those that I care about. And I don't really care what happens in the big DC politics because it does affect me, but there's nothing that you're going to be able to do about it unless, you know, all of society as a whole wakes up, which I don't believe that's going to be a possibility for any time soon whatsoever.
Shit. Yeah. World's crazy.
And that's pretty much all it boils down to. I mean, we're not really getting into current events. I kind of like this. I just want to kind of be this episode with you, Pat. It's kind of just more like an evergreen kind of episode. Someone can come back and listen to it and still glean all the information off of it and put it to use. Really, no matter the political climate or current events that are happening.
Yeah, and that's something I do on my website too, is I'm much more – people are always surprised to hear that I'm not like a gun nut. Like, I might not know what twist rate my AR barrel has, and I might not know the finer points of, you know, how to select which specific ammo for a gun. But I understand the concept. I need a gun. I need ammo. I need strong, solid tactics that I can apply to any situation. So I'm a much more of a concept-driven person, and with the preparedness too. Like, the concept is, how do I save money? The concept is, how do I make money with what I have? The concept is, how do I build a community when the community that I have is kind of, you know, lacking.
Exactly. Now I have a question for you. That's a very hot topic. Steel or brass when it comes to, now with training, I prefer steel. Also with my defensive loads, I personally like steel as well. I'm a more of a cost oriented guy. I don't have any Gucci, you know, $1.50 around, you know, self-defense AR ammo. I just have just normal steel case Tula, little hollow points, and I believe that's what's going to get the job done. So you need it. I think the 109 green tip, 5.56 NATO rounds are a little bit overrated for what they are. Most guys will swear by brass, and I'm just a big guy of, you know, cost saving and, you know, buying as much ammo as I can for the budget that I have. And another big thing that I believe in, if your gun just can't run steel reliably, is it really a reliable gun, in my opinion? Doesn't shoot steel, can't, it doesn't deserve brass.
I don't know the answer to that question, but I can tell you what I do for my pistols. I get two rounds. I buy ball ammo and I buy hollow point, and I find two makes and models of that ammunition that work. And then I buy them in bulk and I just stick to them.
Yeah.
So for the most part, I use ball ammo at the range, but I always fire my hollow points as well while I'm there. And then for my rifle, I just pick one round. And I pick a round that works. I pick hopefully the right grain weight for my rifle.
And at the ranges that you're more than likely going to use your rifle in defensive scenario, it doesn't necessarily matter that much, you know. Yeah, if you're speaking accuracy standpoint, I'm more concerned with steel is not as reliable as brass. Just right now, I have steel ran with my defensive loads because it's all that I have on hand. Now, I will run brass if I come across a good deal on it. Handguns, brass all the time. Not that steel is more unreliable necessarily. I haven't had an issue with it, but I was just able to pick up a large amount of 9mm brass case just for cheap. So that's what I'll use for training. And obviously my defensive loads, good hollow point loads. I'll shoot them every time I go shooting, you know, even if it's just a mag or two. And pretty much it, you know, what works for me might not necessarily work for someone else. You can call me a poor, however, how much you want. That's just how I believe in it. So you're more of the, you said you're not like a really big gun nut. You're more of the utilitarian tool type with your gun.
Yes, very much so.
So you don't have a massive gun collection, but you have guns that have a specific purpose that, you know, you don't just have to have. And, you know, they have to suit your needs for what you need them to do.
Yeah, people are surprised to hear that too. I have a gun that does as much as it can for me. And if I decide to switch, I'll usually sell one to buy another. I'm not a huge gun collector.
I'm a big gun person. You know, if I see a gun that I really like, I'll usually just buy it. Not recently, simply because nothing's in stock. The only gun that I have bought since this whole COVID shit was I just bought a Henry 44 lever action because I've always wanted one. They are really nice guns, in my opinion. It doesn't have a practical use besides hunting and target shooting. Not even really hunting because I bought the brass frame. You know, it's got real pretty walnut on it and stuff. But, you know, like I said, I'm a gun guy. Personally, I just like having them to have them. But I do have a few guns set aside that are completely utilitarian in use. And the rest of them are just kind of hunting and range toys. Which is perfectly fine.
Yeah, nothing wrong with that.
How about your EDC gun? What do you personally use?
I used to carry a Glock 19 for a long time, but I'm getting older and it's easier to make my hips hurt lately. So I carry a Glock 43 and an extra mag, and I have a custom holster because I have a light on my Glock 43 as well. I don't think I'll ever own a gun again that doesn't have an attached light source to it.
That's one thing I'm going to be getting soon is a light for my carry gun. I personally run the 365 XL. I believe now the same thing with the Glock 43. They're pretty much the same gun, especially with the 43X. It's pick a flavor. The Glock is going to run really well. The Sig is going to run really well. I don't have any experience with the Sig. Not the Sig. The Springfield Hellcat. I heard that's an okay one, but I know all the teething problems that had to come with the SIG have been weeded out, and I just personally went with that. It's not that I have a problem with Glocks. I own a couple. I just like my SIG more. I believe the 365, especially in the XL, is probably the most comfortable and concealable gun that you could get for everyday carry. I believe it's the perfect one because it's small enough that you're not going to notice it, but you can still get a full grip on it. And it's not too snappy.
What was the name of that again?
The Sig Sauer 365 XL.
I just held one the other day, but I haven't shot one yet.
very good gun. Couldn't recommend it enough. It does come with the tritium night sights on it, front and rear.
Good.
And I haven't had any issues with it, and that's what I've been carrying. The only thing I need to do is put a good, you know, Surefire weapons light on it and get a holster to fit that. And for, in all reality, any defensive scenario that you need to use that gun in, it holds 12+1 in the standard mag. You can get, I believe, a 15 round that just has a little grip extension on it. But with 13 rounds in such a small package, that'll be able to do whatever you need it to do. And if you surely want to carry a spare mag, get a sidecar holster that'll, you know, fit your needs. I just want the XL because I can get a full hand grip on it and your pinky's not just dangling down below it. It really helps with controllability and shootability, in my opinion.
I agree. Getting your whole hand on a gun is really important.
Another quick thing with handgun shooting. How were you taught to actually use them? Were you more of a point and shoot guy, like a point shooting technique using both eyes, quick and fast up close, or were you a guy that was mainly taught, you know, the proper sight alignment, what you need to do with it?
Sure, we can talk a little bit about that. I'm running short on time, so I'll give you this, and then we'll try and wrap up.
Absolutely.
The fundamentals are important, but they are the fundamentals of target shooting, which sometimes people just call the 8 fundamentals of shooting. A lot of that is a myth, but at first, that can be very important.
Yeah, you got to know how to actually, you know.
Sure.
I wouldn't say actually operate your gun, but, you know, learn the fundamentals, in my opinion. I was taught that from a very young age. That's how I used to shoot, you know, slow but accurate and very controlled. And as I got older and, you know, more finely tuned with those fundamentals, I was more of like, okay, how am I going to put this into practical terms? Because when you need to use your handgun, and especially in a defensive scenario, you got to get it on and get it ripping as fast as you can.
Right. And I'm a believer that if I have, and I do have students that I've taught, I've skipped all of the 8 fundamentals of shooting and I've moved immediately into combat effectiveness of shooting. So it can be done, but there are times when you should go back to some of those fundamentals and to touch on them and to explain them. But it's tough when you use these hard, fast rules in shooting and you teach people with a target shooting mindset, but you expect them to use that skill in self-defense. So they're two very different things. So I can't give a whole class here, but just be aware that the training should match what you want out of the training. So the training should match the mission.
Absolutely. So let's say, are you more concerned about getting that first shot off first? Are you more concerned about hit placement more than anything?
The only time I would spend a lot of time being concerned about hit placement would be if there are other bystanders in the background or the foreground, or if there's multiple people around. So if an attack happens where it's me and one other dude, and I realize that the decision has been made and that I am morally right in taking lethal action, my first objective is to get my weapon into play as fast as possible. My second objective is to completely overwhelm him with firepower.
So mad dump if need be.
Right. It's to completely stop the threat. Right, as fast as possible. If there are other people around, I now have to start moving into similar but slightly different tactics, which would be timing, shot placement, cover, concealment.
Like, say you're in your local gas station, movement. You know,
yeah,
picking up a hot dog and you're waiting for that order to come out, and the guy's up at the register holding it up. You know, if he's preoccupied with trying to get the money out of the register, you would have time to pull your sidearm and actually imply those fundamentals, and should the aggressor come upon you, you'd be able to apply those fundamentals to be able to stop the threat. Versus, say, at that same gas station, you're pumping gas and this guy comes up to you, and you know you have like a split second decision to be able to make that. You're gonna unholster that weapon and make sure you get you're the first one to fire, because.
Yes.
So it's basically just based on situational, and that's something that we should all practice is, you know, practical application of your defensive tools.
All right, brother. Well, I'm running short on time here, so.
Same here. It's been a good podcast with you. Really enjoy you taking the time out of your very busy schedule to have me on, especially a small starting podcast such as this. But I figured this episode would be less more of the shit show and more just a value oriented, you know, throwing as much information and what works for us out as possible.
I hope so. Well, I was happy to be here, man. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I'd love to have you on again, and maybe we could have more of a shit show kind of podcast.
You know,
just bullshitting with the guys. But I really appreciate it. You've given a lot of information, and as usual, I'm drawing a blank right now. Regardless, great podcast. Really enjoyed talking to you. If you could throw out your handles and your plugs real quick, just to
get that over. I'll keep it easy. So you can head to uncensoredtactical.com. You can find almost everything there. That's it.
Alrighty, don't forget to check out Pat's new book. Very informative, filled with lots of information. Very humorous, mind you.
He threw a lot of good
jokes in there. And, you know, like it's not necessarily, I wouldn't say that the exact, you know, specifics on how to use that lockpicking knowledge, but it's more of like how you should use it. And that's the biggest thing that I like from it. And also your first person perspective.
Thanks.
Quite humorous. Putting the reader in your shoes. I do enjoy that.
All right, brother. Well, it's been a blast.
Thank you. And I appreciate it. This has been the Pennsylvania Patriots podcast. Don't forget to check out Pat. Like I said, get his new book. Very worth it. And I hope you have a great day, Pat. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
All righty.